That's Stanley Turrentine with Two Blue from his 1973 album Don't Mess With Mr. T, arranged by Bob James, who's here on piano. You're also hearing Eric Gale on guitar, Ron Carter on bass, Idris Muhammad on drums, and Richard T on organ. This is Lead Stories. I'm your Trace Lead. It is Tuesday, December the 2nd, and a program I hope you would find interesting. Members of the Congressional Black Caucus yesterday entered on the record their views on the controversial November the 24th decision by a grand jury not to indict Darren Wilson, a former police officer with the Ferguson, Missouri Police Department, for killing 18-year-old Michael Brown on August the 9th. The caucus members, appearing during a special order session, that's a session called at the end of the House legislative business day, they addressed the grand jury's decision and, quote, what it says about where we are and where we need to go, unquote, said Representative Hakeem Jeffries, a congressman from Brooklyn who chaired the session. We discuss this today. Actually, we don't discuss this. We are listening to the testimony today, which consistently pointed to America's unwillingness to acknowledge and deal forthrightly with its greatest challenge ever, racism. Symbolically, they seem to be speaking to themselves, for as they offered their testimony on the record, their colleagues had already cleared out of the House chamber, and the members of the Congressional Black Caucus were essentially all alone. I wanted to share this with you because this many people don't understand how profoundly this situation in Ferguson actually is reverberating within the African-American community, and that it should have, there should be such a dichotomy in the way people are reacting to this. White America has one view, Black America has one view, and we get into that dichotomy all the time. But even though, of course, you know that I regularly attack members of the Congressional Black Caucus and the caucus itself, it was nonetheless quite interesting to hear the feelings of these legislators and what they chose to put on the record as a recorded reaction at the congressional level to the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri. So I want to share that with you. I don't know that we'll cover the whole thing because it was a very long session. But as much as we can share, we will hear what their sentiments are. And it gives a very, in many ways, a poignant view. Particularly, I was particularly impressed or moved by the testimony of Representative Charles Rangel, somebody I criticize all the time. But listening to what they say, it's quite interesting to hear the level at which this situation in Ferguson has hit home. So here we are, members of the Congressional Black Caucus putting on the record yesterday their reactions in terms of the legislative action that they think is needed, and an indirect plea, a direct plea to America to confront this question about this cleavage that we have in the United States along racial lines. The session, again, was called a special order session conducted toward the end of the business day yesterday, and with Congressman Hakeem Jeffries, the chairperson of this special session called.
Under the Speaker's announced policy of January 3, 2013, the gentleman from New York, Mr. Jeffries, is recognized for 60 minutes as the designee of the minority leader.
Mr. Chair, I ask for unanimous consent that all members be given 5 days to revise and extend their remarks.
Without objection.
Hands up. don't shoot, is a rallying cry of people all across America who are fed up with police violence in community after community after community. Fed up with police violence in Ferguson, in Brooklyn, in Cleveland, in Oakland, in cities and counties and rural communities all across America. And so tonight the CBC will stand on the floor of the House of Representatives and for the next 60 minutes speak on the topic, Black in America. What does Ferguson say about where we are and where we need to go? People are fed up all across America because of the injustice involved in continuing to see young, unarmed African-American men killed as a result of a gunshot fired by a law enforcement officer. People in America are fed up with a broken criminal justice system that continues to fail to deliver accountability when law enforcement officers engage in the excessive use of police force. People are fed up with prosecutors who don't take seriously their obligation to deliver justice on behalf of the victims of police violence. Instead, as we recently saw down in Ferguson, Missouri, choose to act as the defense attorney for the law enforcement officer who pulled the trigger and killed Michael Brown. People are fed up. Now, this is a problem that Congress can't run away from, and the CBC stands here today to make sure that Congress runs toward the problem, that we come up with constructive solutions to breaking this cycle, this epidemic, this scourge of police violence all across America. And so I'm pleased today that we've been joined by several of our distinguished colleagues, including the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus, who for the last 2 years has led the charge on behalf of the CBC in dealing with issues of social and racial and economic justice. I'm proud to serve under her. I'm proud that she's on the floor today. We're thankful for her service. And let me now yield to the distinguished gentlelady from Cleveland, Congresswoman Marsha Fudge.
Thank you very, very much. And I thank you, Congressman Jeffries, for leading the Congressional Black Caucus Special Order Hour for the 113th Congress, for your weekly advice, for your weekly message. I thank you. We owe you a debt of gratitude. It is a pleasure to have worked with you for this last 2 years. Mr. Speaker, we are running out of patience. Last week, the nation waited and hoped that justice would finally be served in the case of Michael Brown. We waited to hear our country say loud and clear, there are consequences for taking the lives of others. We waited to hear some reassurance that black and brown boys' lives do matter. But again, we were terribly disappointed and discouraged. The Ferguson grand jury's decision not to indict former officer Darren Wilson was yet another slap in our face. It was a painful reminder that just like with Trayvon Martin and Tamir Rice and so many others, that law enforcement officers kill our black and brown men and boys without repercussions. While some may see the grand jury's decision as the system working as it should, others witnessed what we believe was a blatant miscarriage of justice. Where is the closure for Michael Brown's parents? Where is the understanding for the outrage and desperation of the black community? The fact that our country, the greatest country in the world, remains mired in race relations issues in the year 2014 is an embarrassment. We really should consider taking a long look in the mirror before we go to other countries lecturing to them about the need for democracy and tolerance, when here at home we are unable to fully address our own issues. Mr. Speaker, the House is not in order.
The gentlewoman is correct. The House will be in order. Please proceed.
If we are to learn anything from the tragic death of Michael Brown, we must first acknowledge that we have a race issue that we are not addressing. We must have open, honest, transparent conversations about prejudice, racism, and racial threat. We must also lead conversations with law enforcement about transparency, accountability, and police and community policing. And I want to thank the President today for once again putting a focus on the need for community policing in our country. Mr. Speaker, all lives have value. As members of Congress, it is our responsibility to clearly communicate this message to our voters, our constituents, and our neighbors. Mr. Speaker, enough is enough. I yield back.
Thank the Chair for her eloquent remarks. People have asked all over the country, in some quarters, perhaps in the Congress and in this city, why are people upset? Well, you had an unarmed individual, Michael Brown, who had no criminal record, just graduated from high school, on his way to college, killed in what appears to be the excessive use of police force, left to lie in the hot August sun for 4.5 hours. The immediate response by the police chief is to engage in character assassination of the deceased while refusing to release the name of the officer who pulled the trigger. The Ferguson Police Department responds as if this was a military campaign on foreign soil, not in an American city. The prosecutor decides to get involved and does a document dump, doesn't engage in responsible prosecutorial behavior, fails to ask for a specific charge, allows the officer to testify unabated, doesn't point out inconsistencies between his initial telling of the events on that fateful day and what he said before the grand jury, and then announces all of this late at night and behaves as if he was the defense attorney for Darren Wilson. Why are people upset? Those are just a few of the reasons. It's my honor to yield time now to the distinguished delegate from the District of Columbia, Representative Eleanor Holmes Norton.
I want to thank my good friend from New York for his leadership this evening. It's the kind of leadership he's provided ever since he's come to the Congress, and for the critique he's just offered. But I come to the floor this afternoon to try to convert that critique into an understanding of the big picture. Demonstrations have been going on, even though we're days away from when the indictment did not come down. Why, in a country where you haven't seen demonstrations all across the United States for some time, why have demonstrations of young people broken out all across America? There is a message here that comes from the demonstrations and from the words of the parents of Michael Brown. His father pleaded that Michael Brown not have died in vain. The people in the streets are there to see that Michael Brown has not died in vain. That probable cause once again becomes colorblind. To see that when a young black man goes into the street, he is not consistently and constantly profiled because of the color of his skin. These demonstrations show that this issue of detention and stopping of black men, especially black men in the streets, has been simmering below the surface until this tragedy became a way for it to find an outlet. The provocative stops in the street. Eric Holder, a former U.S. attorney, now the Attorney General of the United States, has been stopped in the streets of the nation's capital. And I say to my good friend, this is a progressive city. I cannot imagine what it must be like across the United States. A young black man in St. Louis held up a poster, which is all about the big picture. It said, "We are all Mike Brown. When my son goes into the street, he is Michael Brown. We want an America so that when he goes into the street, he's like everybody else until he does something wrong and where there's probable cause to show it." That does not occur in any city, in any small hamlet in the United States today. And so, yes, this great tragedy has become a vehicle to express that grievance. There are things that can be done. The president has just come forward with a request for an appropriation for body cameras, small amount, $260-some million. They work. We have found that when police have body cameras, they protect the police as well as protect members of the public. So as we come to grips with the fact that there was no bill, no indictment, I hope we will not lose our focus on the big picture, that we are in essence sending a message to police departments all over the United States, even though you think you may not be doing it. What we're talking about is endemic throughout the United States. People are laying down in peaceful protests. Yes, they're blocking the streets. I must say, when I was a youngster in the Civil Rights Movement, we tried not to inconvenience people. But look, this is a wholly different day. And they mean to draw the attention of the entire public and, yes, of police around the United States to just how much of a festering sore this has been. And so I thank my good friend from New York for leading this special order. I thank the chair of the Congressional Black Caucus for leading us off tonight. And in the spirit of Michael Brown's father, who asked that his son not have died in vain, let us make sure that we support the president's request for pilot program for body cameras, that you send that message back home to your police departments, and that we work together to make probable cause colorblind. I thank my good friend from New York.
Thank the distinguished gentlelady for her observations. We're here as members of the Congressional Black Caucus to have an open, honest, and direct dialogue with America. And in a democracy, there has to be a balance between effective law enforcement on the one hand and a healthy respect for the Constitution and the civil rights of others, particularly African Americans, on the other. And if we're honest, we haven't gotten that balance right. And as a result, we see young, unarmed, innocent African American men gunned down in city after city in America. And we're here to say enough is enough. I'm pleased now to yield to someone who has served this institution incredibly well as a member of Congress, served the country well as a member of the military, the Lion of Lenox Avenue, the distinguished gentleman from the great state of New York and the village of Harlem, Representative Charlie Rangel.
I should extend my remarks.
I never felt more proud of my colleague from New York for the great leadership that he's provided since his arrival in this august body. This is such a great country, and I love it so much. I was raised in the shadow of the Statue of Liberty. And when I graduated from law school, having been the only one in my family having gone to college. I think my mother said, "Thank you, Jesus," and I said something like, "Thanks for the Constitution and thanks for being born in America." Like anything else you love, if there's an illness, if there's a problem, you would want to know, what can you do to cure it? How can you make it all that our country can be? How can we say that we have a cancer, then until we recognize that we do, then we don't really love the country? How can we be able to say that white and black in this country are equal and that those who work hard and live by the rules have the same opportunities each other, when we know that we have this cancer, that sometimes we are able to make the country do a lot better than it has, since our people were the only ones that were actually brought here in chains? But I marched from Selma to Montgomery, and things that I never had the opportunity to dream, because equality never was on the list in my community. But if as a result of this, I've been old, lived long enough to see African-American men and women be elected to local and state offices around this country, to come here and join with 9 African-American members of Congress in 1970, and to walk tall and know that in that short period of time, we've grown to over 40, 45 members of Congress. Does that mean that we've rid ourselves of the cancer? I think not. And how can we do it? By admitting that we do have that problem. Because whether we're talking about Ferguson or Watts or Harlem or Bed-Stuy, until we admit that we have this illness and we have this problem, then singling out the success of some of us in this country does not heal the wounds that have been left through the centuries of racial hatred and prejudice. We've been able to say we were freed by the Emancipation Proclamation, but the truth of the matter is our people have been in slavery more than we've been so-called free people. And the fact that they said that you were no longer a slave didn't mean that you were an American with all the rights and the privileges of it. And it hasn't been that long that I can remember my grandfather from Accomack, Virginia, talking about innocent people being lynched in Virginia. And it hasn't been that long that our people have been granted the constitutional right to what? To vote. And it hasn't been that long ago that they even said that our schools should be desegregated or the military desegregated. And until we reach the point that African-American parents don't have to tell their kids to act differently just because of their color, that they have to succumb to type of conduct that you teach them, on one hand, be a man and stand up for your rights, but if he's in uniform, then beg and plead and don't move, don't say anything that might irritate him. I really believe that the people who unconsciously don't know and don't care about the heavy weight that black folks has carried in this country over the centuries that they were brought here cannot possibly love the country as much as they would if they say it was not a Ferguson problem. It's an American problem. And they should be able to ask, what is it that they could do? And I would humbly suggest the first thing you do is to acknowledge that you have that problem. Some people may talk about payment for restitution for past crimes committed against human beings, but that restitution could be
the ability to say that we're going to make certain that people of color in this country would be able to have access to the same type of education, live where they want to live, compete against anybody for the job, and not feeling that they're inferior because people have been taught that just because they have a different complexion that they are superior. And they take that because they were born on third base, that just being born means they can hit a home run. The fact is that all of us collectively would know that whether you're black or brown or yellow, whatever the complexion is, that the greatest benefit and asset that we have as a nation is that we bring in all of these cultures together to build the greatest nation on earth. So whether we have in Ferguson's in another 10 years or 20 years, it doesn't have to be. What has to be is that we cut this poison out of the system of this great country and openly say that we have this problem, and then, as the parents of Mr. Brown would want, then that death would have been just another sacrifice that one of us has made to wake up this wonderful country to do what has to be done. So let me thank you for constantly reminding us that we've come a long, long way from how we got here, but we have a long way to go. Thank you so much.
Thank the distinguished gentleman from New York for his always eloquent and poignant observations. Let me now yield to one of my dynamic colleagues on the Judiciary Committee, the distinguished gentlelady from Texas, Representative Sheila Jackson Lee.
Allow me to add my appreciation for the continued leadership of my friend and colleague from New York, and to thank the previous speakers. We all associate ourselves with the passion, the commitment, the determination that has been expressed. But let me, as I stand, acknowledge that I am particularly pleased to be associated with distinguished legislators. Many people in this nation have their particular roles as pastors and civil rights leaders. And in a meeting held right before the Thanksgiving holiday, members of the Congressional Black Caucus were reminded of the giant role that they have played over the years in combining passion with legislation, hearings with pain. As early as the 1990s, we held hearings on the questions of excessive force, as well as the issues of racial profiling along the highways of America, the issue of excessive sentencing and the crack cocaine disparities, the issue of dealing with the over-incarceration of minorities and the overfilling of jails. Today, Mr. Speaker, I rise to plead to my colleagues. We are legislators. We cannot legislate without the partnership of Republicans. And so I stand as a Democrat and a member of the Congressional Black Caucus that has always been cited as the conscience of America to say that we need to walk in step on the conspicuous Achilles heels of America. That is the criminal justice system. As we stand here today, every one of us has applauded a police officer, has mourned at their passing in the line of duty, has given them awards, has stood alongside of them, every one of us, and certainly I will not take a back seat to anyone on my respect for law enforcement across the gamut. I recognize that they are here to protect and serve. And I think it is very crucial that our friends in law enforcement recognize the work that members of the Congressional Black Caucus have done, if not individually, but collectively. Let me say that I also admire the young St. Louis Rams players who raise their hands to be able to share in the dignity of those young, peaceful protesters. If we don't affirm nonviolence, then who will? And I think everyone, law enforcement and others who agree or disagree, should recognize young people like the ones in Houston, Texas. Don't shoot. That does not in any way denigrate or disrespect our law enforcement officers. So for just a few minutes, I want to speak about that aspect and how we see the justice system. To my colleagues, this is 2,500 pages. Those documents issued by the DA in San Luis County were 10,000 pages. I am continuing to grow this stack. It is clear that what happened in the grand jury system, for many who don't know that system, those individuals are appointed by a judge. A single judge says, who do I know in the community? Let me see if I can appoint 12 of them. In St. Louis County, it took 9 to indict. And if you listen to New York State Chief Judge Sol Wachtler, who famously remarked that a prosecutor could persuade a grand jury to indict a ham sandwich. When I served on the municipal court, there were many probable cause hearings that we held, and many efforts by police officers to get a warrant to be able to go when they thought there was suspicion of a crime. We work with law enforcement officers. In fact, the data says, according to the Bureau of Justice Statistics, U.S. attorneys prosecuted 162,000 federal cases in 2010, the most recent year for which we have data. Grand juries declined to return an indictment in 11. That's federal. That is not the state system in Missouri, but I can assure you it is comparable. So what happened in Missouri when it relates to the justice system, the criminal justice system? First of all, a grand jury system is not a jury of your peers. A grand jury indictment is not a conviction. It would not have meant, if there was an indictment, that the officer in question was convicted. It would simply mean that we would transition to the jury system, and we'd be able to address the question of Michael Brown's rights. For Michael Brown was protected under the Constitution. The First Amendment not only talks about freedom of religion and speech, it talks about the rights of association and the rights of movement. Michael Brown, an 18-year-old big boy, as his mom and dad lovingly called him, had a right to move, on the streets of America. But he was denied that right. He was denied that right with 7 shots. And so there has to be a question. No one would deny that there is a reason to have a full trial. And the question would be, why didn't the St. Louis district attorney act like many other district attorneys? And I know there are some who are in that role here in this particular floor tonight, which is presenting a case and let the jury ultimately decide, and the facts in the grand jury evidence that a question remained. Let me say these few points as I close. I am a supporter of the executive order of the president with body cams, and there are many legislative initiatives that include that. But we need a broad view of what we're going to do in this situation. As I indicated to you, a grand jury is something different from a trial, a petty jury, or a trial by your peers. And so I would say that what happened in St. Louis was not the way that the process usually goes. Mr. McCulloch threw this on the grand jurors, and you needed 9. And unfortunately, the configuration of that jury made it very unclear that there was not going to be an indictment. So today, I think it is very important that we address several questions. We need to look at the grand jury system here across the nation. We need to look at it in the name of Sean Bell. We need Abadou Diablo, Eric Garner, Robbie Tolan in my community where the police officer was not indicted, Trayvon Martin, a civilian, Michael Brown, and the 12-year-old boy. We need to look at it from the perspective of why isn't community-oriented policing used? Why wasn't it used in Ferguson? Under the Urban Justice Act, which I've introduced, which says that communities that rely heavily on fines and other means of funding their government, their federal funding should be diminished accordingly if their whole base of living and funding is just to stop people along the streets. I said racial profiling, the expanding of civil review boards, civilian review boards, the increasing of diversity, which is being tried, unfortunately, a little late in Ferguson, the use of conservatorships, of taking over police departments until they get it right. And last but certainly not least, educational reformation and teaching our young boys, our minority boys, along with things like My Brother's Keeper. To my colleagues today, this is only the beginning. And I believe, as Martin King said, where do we go from here? It is imperative that legislation joined with compassion, it not only be Democrats or members of the Congressional Black Caucus, but we want partners, Republicans, who realize that the criminal justice system, as it penetrates into local communities, must be enhanced, changed, and reformed. How long can we tolerate the shooting down of our children in streets? And it has nothing to do with one's respect or lack of respect for law enforcement, from the very high levels of the FBI and DEA and ATF to our local constables and sheriffs and police officers. And so tonight, my question is, where do we go from here? The question is a reformation of the grand jury system. And I'd almost say that a special prosecutor should have been the route in Missouri. And I would hope that we would look to legislative fixes with our colleagues to make America better. The Congressional Black Caucus will not be silenced. Those of us who serve on the respective jurisdictional committees will not be silenced. And we'll not be silenced because America is better than this, a country that we love. Where do we go from here? We must fix it and fix it now. Yield back to the gentleman.
I thank the distinguished gentlelady from Texas for lending her powerful voice to this issue. We want a fair, impartial, and colorblind criminal justice system. But if we're honest with ourselves, that doesn't exist for all Americans today. And that undermines the integrity of our democracy. That's not just a black problem or a white problem or a Democratic problem or a Republican problem. That's an American problem. And that's why the Congressional Black Caucus stands on the House floor here today to jumpstart not just a discussion, but a march toward making meaningful progress as we move toward perfecting this great union. It's my honor and my privilege to now yield to my good friend and colleague from the great state of New York, someone who himself is a former prosecutor and who has been involved in the fight for social and racial justice during his tremendous tenure here in the United States Congress. Let me yield to the distinguished gentleman from New York City, the borough of Queens, Congressman Gregory Meeks.
Thank you. And I want to thank my friend and colleague, a great attorney, great legislator, for leading this effort this evening, for not only here on the floor of the House of Representatives, but what you do every day. And in fact, it's an example of what we could follow is how you lead in your district, especially in Brooklyn, rallying around, as I'll talk about later, when you saw a prosecutor not do his job. You were one that led in Brooklyn to say the people will get a people's prosecutor. And folks went to the polls when someone said it couldn't be done. Well, you led and helped make it happen where an incumbent forgot his way and was not representing the people. You helped people get together, go to the polls, and have a new prosecutor in Brooklyn to move forward. And we thank you for that leadership. Today we talk about black in America. What Ferguson says about where we are and where we need to go. Now, as Congressman Jeffries have said, I'm a former prosecutor, so I know about the grand jury system. And I know the failure of the grand jury process as directed, or as some would argue, manipulated, by County Prosecutor Robert McCullough to indict Police Officer Darren Wilson in the shooting death of Michael Brown, Jr., an unarmed Ferguson, Missouri teenager, undermines public confidence and the very notion of equal administration of justice. Now, when you go before a grand jury, all you have to show is that there is probable cause, the lowest standard there is, that a crime was committed. And when you see the process that this prosecutor went through, he tried to try a case, or he came in with a preconceived thought that he did not want an indictment here. For I don't know of any prosecutors that go into the grand jury and don't at least, after it's all done, ask for an indictment. Mr. McCullough never asked for an indictment in this case. So the tragic circumstances in Ferguson and other unfortunate instances around the country have sparked a movement for justice, equality, and change that I believe is critical to the communities affected by miscarriages of justice. But this movement is not just for those communities. Indeed, the United States of America needs this movement. This is, as others have said, an American problem. As Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. once said, injustice anywhere is a threat to justice everywhere. Racial disparities of any kind are troubling for our entire nation. And so, though we've elected President Barack Obama here in the United States, I heard some say that we were in a post-racial America. No, we are not. For racism is still alive and well in the United States of America. We've got work to do. So where do we go? This movement, with this courageous contingent of young activists, is quickly learning, adapting, applying, and innovating on the most effective methods and models of the civil rights movements of previous generations. As this movement continues to grow and takes every opportunity to focus its demands, expand its outreach, develop its activists in the discipline of peaceful direct action, and deepen its understanding of how to apply mass pressure on policymakers, it will cascade not simply to interrupt businesses as usual, but to generate electoral participation on levels unseen in generations. This movement has the potential to transform the tragedy in Ferguson into a historic turning point in the centuries-long struggle for freedom, justice, and equality. The Congressional Black Caucus is part of this moment and a part of this movement. Tens of thousands of federal, state, and local elected officials, civic leaders, civil rights organizations, activists, clergies, lawyers, educators, artists, athletes, business owners, and hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of ordinary working people of all ages from all over America are part of this movement. So now is the time for America to come together to reform police practices, redress patterns of racial disparities in the justice system, and to hold police accountable for the use of excessive force, especially deadly force. Now is the time to match nonviolent direct action with meaningful legislative and administrative action. Now is the time for the federal government to act, for Congress to act, for courts to act, for state legislatures to act, for country and county and city governments to act. Now is the time, my friends, to register to vote, because soon, very soon, it will be time to act at the ballot boxes. Only then will these voices be truly heard in every corner of every county and throughout this country. And then the world will know that unwarranted violence and abuse of power has no home in America. Injustice has no seat in our democratic institutions. And only then will we honor the sacrifice of those who have paid the ultimate price and begin to heal a nation of many who aspire to become one. Yes, indeed, we've come a long way. But yes, indeed, we have a long, long, long way to go. Thank you for the time.
Thank my good friend, the distinguished gentleman from New York, for his very eloquent and thoughtful remarks, as always. And now it's my honor and my privilege to yield to a great civil rights leader, former judge, and the distinguished gentleman from the great state of Texas, Representative Al Green.
Thank you very much, and I thank the speaker as well. I want to make mention of Mr. Horsford. He is not here tonight, but I always associate him with Mr. Jeffries. They have been a great dynamic duo, and they've done outstanding work with these special order hours. And in his absence, I want to let him know that we still greatly appreciate him and we miss him. Mr. Speaker, I had a John Carlos moment. For edification purposes, John Carlos was the athlete at the 1968 Olympics who went to the podium along with Tommy Smith and raised his hand in what was called at that time a Black Power salute. At that time, much was said about John Carlos and Tommy Smith. Many people criticized them for taking the podium and for making this gesture. They were said to be outside of the mainstream. But I believe that history has vindicated them because they were a part of the avant-garde. They actually were causing many people to understand that the Black Power movement at that time was much bigger than many thought. I had a John Carlos moment because I saw this clip where the Rams players came into the arena, hands up, don't shoot. It was a John Carlos moment because this has become the new symbol. A statement wherein people around the country now are calling to the attention of those who don't quite understand that this is a movement that will not dissipate. It will not evaporate. It's a movement that is going to continue because young people, a new generation, has decided that they are going to engage themselves in the liberation movement, the freedom movement, if you will, the continuation of what happened in 1968 with John Carlos and Tommy Lee Smith. And I want to make sure that those who participated on the Rams team, that their names are chronicled in history. I want people who look back through the vista of time to know who they were when they searched the congressional records. So I want to add their names to this record. I want Kenny Britt to be recognized, Tavon Austin to be recognized, Stedman Bailey to be recognized, Jared Cook, Craig Givens, and Trey Mason. These are persons who in the years to come will be acknowledged as a part of the avant-garde. And I want people to know also that I appreciate and support what the president is doing with his executive action. I support what he's doing with body cameras. And I support what he's doing with body cameras because I believe that body cameras can exonerate and they can as well incriminate. They can exonerate officers who are falsely accused. They can provide empirical evidence of what actually transpired. There won't be he said or she said. There will be the empirical evidence of what the camera actually saw. They can also incriminate those who would try to perpetrate a fraud upon the American people. Body cameras can identify those who would engage in criminal conduct and then try to excuse their conduct with words that don't match what the camera will reveal. I believe in body cameras. This is why I have filed H.R. 5407, the TIP Act, Transparency in Policing. The TIP Act would cause the Justice Department to examine the circumstance in this country, the cost for body cameras, and would then allow those jurisdictions that cannot afford to incorporate body cameras into their police departments, there would be an exemption for them, but would require those, generally speaking, who receive federal dollars to move to body cameras. I regret that we are getting to a point now where we are getting it right after the fact. We shouldn't get it right after the fact. This is what's happening in Ferguson. After the fact, Ferguson is moving to body cameras. But We don't need another Ferguson. There are other communities around the country where, after the fact, they are moving to body cameras. We don't need to have an injustice take place before we move to a just circumstance and incorporate these body cameras. My hope is that we will follow the president's lead, that we will incorporate body cameras into police departments across the length and breadth, the scope of this country, if you will. But I also pray that this bill, H.R. 5407, will get a hearing. It is overwhelmingly supported by members of the CBC as well as others. It is not a CBC initiative, but it is supported overwhelmingly by the CBC. And my hope is that this bill will get a fair hearing, because we should not get it right after the fact. We should have an opportunity to eliminate a lot of what we see as confusion and chaos. We need not continue to add fuel to the flame of confusion. That flame can be eliminated if we but only had these body cameras. They are not a cure-all, they're not a panacea, but they are a positive step in the right direction. I salute the president and thank him for what he's doing, and I pray that we will get a fair hearing on H.R. 5407. God bless you, dear brother. And I pray that you will continue to do what you're doing on the floor of the House and giving us this voice so that we may reach the American people.
Thank the distinguished gentleman from Texas. It's now my honor and my privilege to yield time. Mr. Chair, how much time do we have remaining?
Approximately 14 minutes are remaining.
Let me now yield to my good friend, the distinguished congresswoman who represents the neighboring district at home in Brooklyn. She's a fighter for justice, a voice for the voiceless, and it's now my privilege to yield to Congresswoman Yvette Clark.
Hands up, don't shoot. I thank my colleague and friend, Mr. Jeffries of Brooklyn, New York, for his tremendous leadership, both here in Washington, D.C., and at home in New York. I rise to join my colleagues in the Congressional Black Caucus to discuss being black in America and what the injustice in Ferguson, Missouri says about where we are and where we need to go as a civil society. I first want to once again offer my condolences to the family of Michael Brown, whose efforts to secure justice on behalf of their son were undermined by the decision of the grand jury. The killing of Michael Brown and attacks by the Ferguson Police Department on protesters demonstrate an assumption that young women and men who are African American are inherently suspicious, a false assumption with deadly consequences. So where do we go from here? We must not allow this false assumption to prevail in our nation, in our society. We cannot and will not accept the devaluation of African American lives. We have seen this scenario play out too many times in recent years. Even in my hometown in Brooklyn, New York, where we are still reeling from the recent killing of Akai Gurley, an unarmed young man shot by a probationary New York City police officer. This killing on the heels of the homicide by chokehold of Eric Garner on Staten Island, again in New York City. Mr. Speaker, it's deeply disappointing that as we observe the 50th anniversary of the Civil Rights Act of 1964, we are still trying to fulfill the promise of the 14th Amendment of equal protection under the law. While the Civil Rights Act of 1964 transformed our nation by prohibiting discrimination based on race, religion, color, sex, and national origin at work, in schools, and in other public facilities, we still must transform the perceptions, biases, and prejudices that some people still carry with them like luggage from generations past. The incidents in Ferguson and cities across this nation reminds us that communities that have been disproportionately and unjustly targeted by police departments demand recognition of their humanity. Young people of color refuse to live in a democratic society in a state of fear, and we have an obligation as a nation to rid ourselves of the scourge of racially biased state-sanctioned terrorism. I fully support the steps announced today by the Obama administration to strengthen community policing and fortify the trust that must exist between law enforcement officers and the communities they serve. I have been a vocal advocate for better relations between the community and law enforcement community. Given the police officer's sole mission is to serve and protect the people with dignity, integrity, and respect, we must focus on achieving that mission. I pledge to work with my constituents, the Obama administration, my colleagues, and officials across this country, especially in New York City, to restore public trust and to establish a more enlightened policing strategies and to prevent such incidents in the future. So again, I'd like to thank Mr. Jeffries for his leadership. I want to thank the CBC, the Conscience of the Congress, for holding this timely special order. To all Americans who are disturbed by the demonstrations that are taking place across this nation, I want you to remember these four words: no justice, no peace. And I yield back.
Thank you, Congresswoman Clark. Mr. Speaker.
That was Congresswoman Yvette Clark bringing up the rear there. We're going to leave it there for the day. But I just wanted to share with you what members of the Congressional Black Caucus registered as their concerns and opinions at a special order session. That's a session that's called at the end of the legislative business day. Unfortunately, of course, as I noted before, the testimonies offered in this special session were not heard by the rest of the House. They had already cleared out. But it is in the record, and it is important that we acknowledge and listen to what their concerns were as they expressed them, because, you know, very often, as you know, it's the Congressional Black Caucus has gotten its fair share of barbs from me. But it is interesting to hear the consistency of their arguments as they pose them on the record. So we will be talking about this. We'll come back to this and refer to it in another discussion. But it was important to share that with you today. And that brings us to the end of the program. I hope it sheds some kind of light on how the killing of Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, has been reverberating not only across the nation, but now, as we hear, in the halls of Congress as well. Stay tuned. Coming up next is The Infectious Myth with David Crow. You can certainly reach me at leadstories@gmail.com and on Facebook, Lead Stories with Eutrice Lee. As always, a pleasure and a great privilege being in your company. I hope this program was helpful to you today. Bye-bye.